Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here in WILL AM 580. We're coming at you live today from Campbell Hall here in Urbana. And today's a special day for us. We have a guest that ever since we began the program and the list of prospective guests was being made last winter, one name kept coming up over and over as someone we wanted to have on, and that's Tom Frank, the writer and the cultural critic from based out of Chicago. Tom Frank is the founding editor of The Baffler, a magazine of cultural criticism, and he's the author of two very important books. The first one, the one that exposed me to his work the first time, is called The Conquest of Cool, published by the University of Chicago Press, based on Tom's dissertation in history at the University of Chicago. And it is a wonderful, brilliant, and original take on the advertising industry in the 1960s. He followed that up remarkably with a book that I think is really one of the most important and engaging books in writing in the past few years called One Market Under God, Extreme Capitalism, Market Populism, and the End of Economic Democracy. Tom Frank is a frequent commentator on NPR, ABC's World News Tonight, and he writes for The Wall Street Journal, The Nation, Harper's, and many other places. It is a real pleasure to have Tom Frank with us today. Tom, are you there? Hello, Tom. Ooh, Tom is not here yet. I guess we're still working on our connection with Tom. And while we're getting that arranged, let me tell you a little bit more about Tom and what he is. Hello, Tom.
Bob?
Yeah, okay, Tom, we've got you. Good. Yeah, it's high technology here.
Yeah. I'm sorry about that. I don't know what I did to make that happen.
No, I think it was probably some cultural studies person or something. Michael Berube came back. I forgot to press a button, so you'll have to forgive me. That shows my high technology, if I can.
Okay. You know, I just recently got a push-button phone here.
Mm.
Yeah, and it's been giving me all sorts of headaches.
Yeah, can you program the time on your VCR?
Yes, I can do that. I followed the instructions in the booklet.
Oh, you're astonishing. No wonder you're such a great writer. one thing I should say is One Market Under God, for those of our listeners who are not familiar with it or haven't read it, is unlike almost any other book of political commentary, social commentary that's been published in years. It is truly a pleasure to read. Tom is a gifted writer. And the book is really, it's a biting social criticism combined with a stunning sense of humor. I mean, there are points in this book where literally I'm on the floor laughing at the absurdity of our times, which I think you point out as well as any writer of our generation or of our age. And so that's why it's such a pleasure to have you here. And for starters, I mean, it's the greatest title of a book I've ever seen. I mean, it is
cut
just
it out. You're embarrassing.
Well, it's true. This book, One Market Under God. What could say it better? What's the reason you wrote this book? And what's the basic point of the book?
Well, it was about. I wrote it, in the late '90s, when the sort of new economy hysteria was peaking, and the idea was to shoot that stuff down. Was to say that we are in a that we were going through some kind of that we were deluding ourselves, that we were going through some kind of weird national mania about the free market, and it was a very different world. That was just 2 years ago.
It's almost like talking about the War of the Roses now.
Yeah. Right. It's hard to really even remember how crazy things were. And while I was writing it, I read the Wall Street Journal every day. I would read Fortune magazine, a bunch of business magazines, and I would watch CNBC. I sort of would have that on in the background all day. And I read great heaps of management literature and this kind of thing. Really tried to immerse myself in new economy thinking. And also, the main thing that I did was to historicize this. One of the historicize all this crap that was coming out. One of the things about the new economy, the mania of the late '90s, was this idea that we had transcended history and that we were no longer subject to, any of the traditional the rules of economics, of capitalism, and that history just didn't matter. It no longer touched us. And what was really creepy about all that was that it had all been said and done before,
mm-hmm.
In the 1920s especially. But this you know, seems to be, there's like this cultural analog to the boom and bust cycle where capitalist thinkers are just convinced of these same things every 50 years or so.
Mm-hmm.
And the sort of climactic point in all that was in December 99, Forbes magazine put a quote on its cover from this this one of the great heroes of the 1920s. His name is escaping me at the moment, but his famous remark was, "Everybody ought to be rich." His name was Raskob. That was his name, John J. Raskob, and he was a big financier in the late 1920s. And he wrote an article in a popular magazine, may have been Ladies Home Journal, I forget, but the title of the article was, "Everybody ought to be rich," and the idea was that if we all put our money in the stock market, we wouldn't need government intervention in the economy, we wouldn't need labor unions, we wouldn't need national health insurance, we could stave off socialism through the stock market, and he said that everybody would prosper through this system, and he had an actual plan for how he could get everybody in the country into the stock market, and this came out in like August 1929, mm-hmm. right before the crash, and so he became this overnight laughingstock. Well, Forbes magazine took his quote, and also had been sort of taking his crazy ideas all through the 1990s, but they took his quote and put it on the cover of their magazine in December 1999. So this is like 4 months before the NASDAQ started to crash, and said, this guy has been vindicated. Everybody will be rich. It was just the creepiest thing. It was, they made this guy into a two-time jinx. Extraordinary.
Well, Forbes magazine, which is really, I think, I read all those same magazines as you, so as part of my work, and they seem to really be sort of the red meat for this argument. They're the most gung-ho of the business press and the least critical has been my experience.
Forbes, you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah, they're extremely ideological. I don't know, the Wall Street Journal op-ed page gives them a run for the money, but the Wall Street Journal proper does very excellent reporting.
Yeah, it's a great newspaper.
Forbes is Forbes seems to me to be party line from front to back. It never deviates. It's this highly politicized reporting.
And we've got,
I almost said biased there, Bob. But
oh my God, better watch that. But one of my favorite Forbes magazine commentators who shows up in One Market Under God is George Gilder.
Yeah.
And he's an interesting guy. Why don't you tell us a little bit about him?
He's fascinating. He's a piece of work, but he's also, I'm afraid his moment has passed. That Forbes in the early 90s started a special supplement to Forbes just for Gilder. It was called Forbes ASAP. And they would run every couple of months, they'd run these really long articles by the guy that he would then fashion into books. And the last issue of that just came out. I believe they have discontinued Forbes ASAP. He had bought the American Spectator there at the very end of the 90s, and he just lost that too. So he's in big trouble. But the real Gilder is he fascinates me. He started out as in the 1970s as this anti-counterculture guy, and he wrote a series of books, anti-feminist books, that are pretty much forgotten today. It's very hard to get copies of them. And he really hit the big time in the very early 80s. He wrote a book called Wealth and Poverty that Ronald Reagan just loved. It became a huge bestseller.
I remember it well.
Yeah, he became a speechwriter for Reagan, and wrote some of Reagan's most memorable things. And the book was about how capitalists are always besieged by these horrible socialists, and this kind of, it's very resentful capitalism. But he also had this weird angle where capitalism is almost divine. Capitalism is the way of God. In Kansas, they have an expression: "God is a Republican." That's sort of tongue in cheek. But with Gilder, that's that was revealed truth. But then he went from there. He took this turn in the late 80s into the world of technology and went from being this this Reaganite to being this tech writer, and wrote a very famous book called Microcosm. It's about the microchip. And what's fascinating is that through all these changes, Gilder's politics stayed the same. It's just that he kept coming up with different mechanisms for proving that they were the way of God. You know, earlier it had been this kind of, you know, this kind of free market economics, and then he decided that the microchip, you know, which was this nearly divine force that nobody could resist, also was like pro-capitalist, and the microchip was going to insist that the free market way would take over all the world. And then he became the great after that, and that was of course huge because all the companies that he discussed in that later, there, you know, there, then the stock market boom started shortly afterwards, and these companies all became very valuable. He started a newsletter in the mid 1990s. By that time, he had become interested in the internet and in fiber optics and in telecommunications. And he started doing a investor tip sheet in the mid-1990s. And this is where the story really gets weird, because he went from being an ideologue to being a stock picker. And for a while, he was the most celebrated stock picker of them all in the late 1990s. He could do no wrong. And it got to be one of these situations where he had become such a great stock picker that had become self-fulfilling, and every time he even mentioned a company in his newsletter, the price would go up because everybody thought he was so right that they rushed to buy it and therefore made him right. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, in fact, let me interrupt for 1 second to say, Tom, that because I subscribed to Forbes and all his business magazines, I would get the flyers for his stock picking service constantly.
Yeah.
And they would have these astronomical reports. It'd be like getting a bookie service. I get those too because I subscribe to sports magazines. Like, you know, give Gilder $1 and you'll be worth $3 billion in 6 weeks.
Yeah.
It was extraordinary claims.
I have when I give a lecture now, that sort of summarizing One Market Under God, and I have in that lecture I do a slideshow that goes with it, and I have a pretty funny visual. It's the mailing that he sent out also at the very end of 99, trying to drum up subscriptions for his newsletter. His newsletter is very expensive, by the way, and you know, it's really funny because it claims that he is prophetic and that he has these, you know, these powers of seeing that ordinary people do not. You know, it's remarkable stuff. Anyhow, it all ended pretty badly for Gilder. By the way, I should also mention I have members of my family who bought into this stuff and who came to Gilder not just because he was supposed to be this great stock picker, but came to him through ideology, through the Rush Limbaugh route, and it really ended badly for them. His portfolio of stocks is now off over 90% from the highs of the highest point ever, which is March 2000. So if you had bought in at any time in that last year, you know, when he was this celebrated figure and was being written about all the time in the press and was sending out these solicitations for his newsletter, you would be, you know,
wiped out.
Yeah, it would be disastrous.
Yeah.
And anyhow, so, but Gilder himself, you know, he's a little bit apologetic. He has all his newsletter business has expanded. He now does newsletters about four different industries. And you know, I don't know why anybody would take the man's advice now, but he keeps churning it out. He has this resentful style where he is always the victim, and you know, so he sort of merged this kind of backlash sensibility, you know, this kind of Archie Bunker sensibility with real high tech capitalism. It's fascinating stuff. He also has a very very religious edge to it all. He's fascinating.
We're talking to Tom Frank today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. We are accepting phone calls, and I think anything is pretty much fair game with Tom. The number here...
One thing, Bob, I don't pick stocks.
Except, yeah, picking stocks. 333-9455 is our local number, and the toll-free number is 1-800-222-9455. The lines are open. Feel free to call in. Next week on Media Matters, we're going to have a special show. We've got two heads of media workers' unions, Shelby Scott from AFTRA, the Film and Television Workers Union and Radio Workers Union, and Linda Foley, the head of the Newspaper Guild, the Journalist Union, will be joining us. Shelby will be in the studio with us, Linda on the phone lines from Washington, D.C. And you'll get a chance to hear about the media industry from a side that's rarely spoken about, from that of the people who actually do the work in the trenches. So join us next week for Media Matters. Now back to Tom Frank, our guest for today. The thing, Tom, about Gilder that's interesting related to your book is that he really sort of encompasses this sort of combination of market enthusiasm or religious fervor with new technologies equaling this super populist mechanism where everyone can get rich.
Yeah, this is what's so fascinating about the 1990s. This is the theme of the book that I come back to again and again and again, is this notion of market populism, that markets are effectively the same thing as democracy. In fact, markets are much more democratic than any kind of political democracy. But, you know, and that was, in my opinion, that was the centerpiece of all your different new economy ideas, whether it's the stock market, you know, the idea that the stock market had been democratized and that even little old ladies in Beardstown, Illinois were cashing in, or, you know, in management theory, the idea that the new revolutionary corporation was empowering its workers and was tearing down the old hierarchies and everything. The idea is that the market is this powerful, inexorable, you know, juggernaut of democracy, and that whatever the market touches, it democratizes. And there are still people, you know, that now seems pretty preposterous, but there are still people who believe that. In New York Times Magazine, I think it was just last week, Michael Lewis, maybe it was 2 weeks ago, Michael
yeah.
Lewis had this story about, you know, sort of shaking his finger at all the, or I guess maybe his fist at all the naysayers who he thinks shot down the new economy, and saying, "How could you do such a thing? It was democratizing the world. The new economy was the greatest thing that ever happened. It was bringing us, you know, economic democracy." In my opinion, just the silliest thing you could ever argue for, and yet it was everywhere. And you know, I don't know how.
Well, you know, it was following the piece the week before, Part One, which was written by Paul Krugman,
right?
Which
where
took all the statistics.
Exactly the opposite.
Yeah, took all the statistical data to show how ludicrous these claims were and how indefensible they were.
Yeah, exactly. And that was, I mean, Krugman really, really nailed that one, and proved, you know, to my set, you know, beyond a doubt that what actually went on during the bull market, like what actually goes on during every bull market, is not the democratization of wealth, but the concentration of wealth. You know, it doesn't matter that you and I, that it's easier for us now to open an account with a discount brokerage, and that we can you know, look online and get stock quotes online. That's you know, effectively insignificant. That just doesn't matter. The way these things work is precisely the opposite. Is, you know, we're finding out, to our great dismay. Look, one of the great myths of the stock market in the 90s was that the insiders no longer had an advantage over the little guy. Peter Lynch wrote, you know, the great mutual fund manager, wrote a series of books on this very subject, the idea that you and I could pick stocks better than Wall Street experts, because what really mattered in stock picking was you know, picking brand names, and anybody could do that. And the Wall Street experts, in the meantime, were deluded by all these highfalutin, you know, fancy pants ideas that were getting in the way of simple, practical stock picking. And therefore, you know, little old ladies could whip the pros. And, you know, it turned out to be just exactly the opposite. The pros were, you know, were deceiving people all along with the help of CNBC. They were giving all sorts of they're helping out the insiders to, you know, to a degree that's unimaginable, like this guy at WorldCom or like the guys at Enron, and the little people were listening to George Gilder and Rush Limbaugh and getting screwed.
You know, there's one section of your book that I've just reread this morning, so it's just classic, which is a discussion of I think it was a bestseller that came out in the 1990s called The Millionaire Next Door.
Yeah, it's still on. If you look on the Wall Street Journal bestseller list, it still appears.
Yeah, that book seems to really encapsulate a lot of the sort of argument that you make, and it really crystallizes the sort of absurdity of the argument. What's that book about?
The Millionaire Next Door, it's the idea that these people did a survey, not a very, you know, it didn't look like a very precise survey to me, but what do I know? These two college professors I think they're business school professors, did a survey of millionaires and decided that millionaires in America actually had really average habits and tastes and were really regular people, and that the best way to become a millionaire was, or that effectively the point is that millionaires are just like you and me, only much, much, much more so. And this is a very common argument that you heard. Dinesh D'Souza wrote a whole book on this subject, I think, that came out right at about the time of the crash, arguing that that the new breed of billionaires were, you know, they were this notion that,
like, there's one guy named Bubba who's in there that they talk about as the standard new type of millionaire.
Pickup truck or something.
Yeah.
Therefore, the whole idea is to short-circuit class conflict by saying that, look, these millionaires aren't so bad. They don't eat at fancy French restaurants. They don't wear suits. They're regular guys. You know, they ride their bikes to work. They're really unaffected. They're down with the people. They don't wear suits. They're like Bill Gates. He eats hamburgers. You know, they're like Warren Buffett. They're, you know, kindly people that live next door. They're not these distant, you know, hateful people like, say, Jay Gould or J.P. Morgan or this kind of, you know, robber baron image. They're just regular people. And you know what, Bob? It just doesn't matter to me what kind of clothes they wear. You know, the class system still functions the way it always has. We have a story about this in the upcoming issue of The Baffler, which is going to be out in about a month. The Baffler, by the way, is a magazine that I edit here in Chicago. But there's a whole cottage industry of conservatives, you know, continually writing books about how social class is strictly a matter of taste anymore, and that economics don't have anything to do with it. It's all about taste because we're such a democratic society.
Yeah, like that Bobos in Paradise
yeah,
book.
Yeah, that's right. He's David Brooks is one of the authors of this argument. We've got a story in the magazine about this. But you also see it on the left. Cultural studies people sort of embrace the same idea. They don't so much embrace it as they just ignore the economic side. It's all just about taste. You know, are you a fan of this? Are you a fan of that? And you can be a fan of whatever you choose, you know, blah, 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 blah. And economics is pretty much out of the picture.
How did this stuff, I mean, how widespread was this in the 90s? And, I mean, how did it catch on? I mean, considering it went against, as Krugman has pointed out and as Kevin Phillips and all the statistics show, it went against what actually took place throughout most of that decade.
Yeah.
How did it become so dominant?
Well, the word that I use for it is consensus. This was something that was shared across the opinion spectrum in the 90s. You know, you'd read Tom Friedman in the New York Times. You'd read James Glassman in the Washington Post. You'd read, you know, whoever in the Wall Street Journal, Forbes magazine. This was something that you saw everywhere. It contradicted what was actually going on. And what was very apparent to anybody that really cared to look, if you went out there and did research at the time, like someone like Barbara Ehrenreich did, you could see that what was going on was not empowerment. And yet, the only stories that you saw in the 1990s, I'm even talking about respectable magazines here, you know, Time and Newsweek, were about how workers, you know, maybe their wages were falling, but they all had stock portfolios now, and that more than made up for it. There's just, during bull markets like this, there's this incredible capacity to shut your eyes, to ignore reality. It was not just a bubble in the stock market. It was a bubble, an intellectual bubble as well. You know, with people constantly one-upping each other, and it's a bizarre phenomenon. If you want me to go on, I have some historical sort of explanations for how it got started.
Well, you know, I do in a second, but as you might know, if you look out your window, Tom, because I think it's in Chicago too, we've got some pretty bizarre weather going on.
What is it? A tornado or something?
I don't know, but we fortunately have someone who does know, and we're going to turn it over to him right now. Ed Kieser is going to give us a brief update on the weather, and we'll be right back with the show in just a minute or so. Okay.
Okay,
let's go to Ed now.
Okay, thank you very much. Quick update, there is still a tornado watch in effect for much of east central Illinois and west central Indiana in our severe weather coverage area. Vermilion, Douglas, Edgar, Coles, Cumberland, and Clark counties are under the tornado watch. It's in effect until 5 p.m., but I think it will be canceled soon. In Indiana, that watch includes Warren, Fountain, Vermilion, Park, and Vigo counties. The severe weather is now just south and east of our coverage area, our severe weather coverage area. There are some nasty storms in southern Illinois with a tornado warning there. There are severe thunderstorm warnings for some counties just west of Indianapolis, Hendricks, northern Morgan, and eastern Putnam counties under severe thunderstorm warnings. And storms are also pushing into northeast Indiana. So this afternoon, if you're in Indiana except for the northwest corner, and if you're in southern Illinois, I would watch out. For the rest of the area, it is looking better. A few showers later on today. Still a mild 60 degrees with cooler air coming in later this afternoon. And that's the update on the weather. Back to Media Matters.
Thanks a lot, Ed. It looks like it'll be safe for those tailgating Media Matters listeners for the Bears game. You won't be caught in a tornado or a hurricane today. Our guest today on Media Matters is Tom Frank, the author of One Market Under God. Tom's talking to us from his home in Chicago. Tom is also the editor of the cultural magazine The Baffler. Tom, how do you get a hold of The Baffler?
Well, it's hard to find in stores. Your best bet is to go to our website, which is thebaffler.com, it gives you the information there. Or you can always write to our P.O. box. Back in the early 90s, I used to always give out the P.O. box on the air. Can I do it for old time's sake?
Sure.
It's P.O. box 378293, Chicago, Illinois, 60637.
You know, listeners who didn't get that down, I've got another way to do it. You can email our producer, D.B. Scott, dbscott@uiuc.edu, and he will get that information to you. So if you didn't get it down, just email our producer, dbscott@uiuc.edu, and that's Ben's email, and he'll take care of that. Also, if you'd like to be on our weekly mailing list here at Media Matters, we will send out weekly updates once a week to anyone who wants them, telling about upcoming guests, with giving links to their work, to organizations they work with. So in this week's, we would send out all the information about Tom Frank, how to get a hold or find out about his book or The Baffler. You can do that also by simply emailing the producer, Ben Scott, at dbscott@uiuc.edu, and Ben will get you all fixed up. Please do that. We promise no commercial solicitations. Just one message a week, purely informational. And if you ever want to get off, all you have to do is email us, and we'll take your name off it. We won't sell a list to anyone, anything like that. Our guest today is Tom Frank on Media Matters. Our phone lines are open if anyone's interested in calling in. The number is 333-9455, and our toll-free number is 1-800-222-9455. Tom, you know, one of the things in your book that's quite profound that really goes to the heart of this notion of market populism was the attitude towards people's intellect. I mean, because on one hand, like you say with Gilder, the idea of market populism, that markets are great, is premised on the idea that people and markets are geniuses, and that anything you do as a market, you know, when you buy something, it reflects absolute genius. But people in all other arenas are morons. I mean, right. If they vote for candidates or anything like that, then they all of a sudden become a bunch of dummies.
Urbana, mostly cloudy with scattered showers and thunderstorms. Temperatures steady in the upper 50s with west winds around 15 miles per hour. Tonight, mostly cloudy with a low in the mid-30s.
Tom?
Can I talk?
Yeah. I thought it was you doing your impersonation of our weather person, and it was a dead-on impersonation.
What you're putting your finger on, this is one of the most striking things about the new economy thinking that probably won't go away anytime soon, and that is its rampant anti-intellectualism. Anti-intellectualism is a very old American tradition, but it really came into its own in the new economy days. Business people have always been suspicious of intellectuals because, you know, intellectuals are forever, appearing on blue ribbon committees and writing books about how to regulate them and stuff like that. But in the new economy, it became something much more than that. You know, you had this idea that the market was this incredibly intelligent, almost omniscient machine.
It could do no wrong.
Sorry?
It could do no wrong.
Yeah, that's right. It could. It never makes a mistake. The invisible hand sees to that. And so any effort, it's almost a natural thing. Any effort by humans to try to regulate it or fix it or even criticize it in any way is an example of man getting above himself, of a certain kind of arrogance. I should also say that since the market is automatically the expression of the will of the people, the market speaks with the vox populi. To criticize it or to try to regulate it is an act of arrogance. And the word that they loved to use was elitism. So this is essentially brings all your anti-intellectual villains together, you know, your Harvard professors along with your labor movement, everybody else. They think they know better than the people. And what was really creepy to me was how this anti-intellectualism would seep down into really unlikely parts of the new economy thinking, into really practical everyday advice. And what I'm referring to here are stock picking advice books. And I read a great number of these. In them, the idea is that you don't try to figure things out. People who have all these highfalutin ideas and try to try to figure out the market always lose. The Wall Street experts are you know fundamentally deluded and wrong. While the average guy looking at brand names in his cupboard or something like that and picking stocks that way, that's who's always going to win out. And this was a really common theme all through the 1990s. You saw it everywhere. And I guess I'm just showing you here what an elitist I am.
I think so. And Tom Frank, I want to ask you now, as we talked about, as you mentioned right at the beginning, the book now, although it was just published 2 years ago, looks like it's describing a period in history that was decades ago so much has happened. And, you know, what is your sense of the corporate scandals in the business downturn? What's your take on that?
Oh, it was a perfect crisis. You know, the Enron people were this was the one that I paid most attention to. But in some ways, you know, the things that happened refuted the new economy faith so perfectly. The Enron people, among other things, were not only a business, but they were also heavily ideological.
The Amway of the new economy.
That's right. They were really into free market theory. And I remember when they deregulated electricity here in Illinois in 1997, Enron came into the state with millions of dollars and was running ads on radio here in Illinois in favor of deregulation. And that's when they first drew my attention because, you know, I was, why is Enron doing this? They're a company out of Texas. Who are they? You know, and that's when I first started looking into who Enron was. But not only that, they pushed deregulation in the states. They helped to write deregulation bills, and then they used deregulation to game the markets, to totally play the markets, knowing that a deregulated market really isn't democracy, and that free markets really aren't what they're cracked up to be. The insiders were just playing the little people like you play a piano. It was exactly the opposite of what free market theory promised. Enron, by the way, one of their ads that they used to run showed the civil rights demonstrators in the streets of Birmingham in 1964. And the idea was that that's what the company was doing, in calling for deregulated markets. These people were just monsters.
Yeah, so if Dr. King, were he with us today, would be sort of leading the deregulatory battle arm in arm, linked arm with Newt Gingrich and George Gilder.
That's right. And it's not just them. There are lots of companies that liked to use that imagery.
Enron was, if I'm not mistaken, on Fortune or Forbes or Wall Street Journal that does these annual lists, or maybe Business Week, it was the number one company for 2 or 3 years in a row, sort of the go-go new economy superstar.
Yeah. It was the most admired. It was supposed to be the most creative. That was a word they liked to use a lot, creativity. They were beloved of the management theorists. There's a guy called Gary Hamel, one of the management theorists I talk about in the book. He came out with a book called Leading the Revolution. I think it appeared at just about the same time as One Market Under God. And in that, it was your classic work of 90s management theory, all this crap about revolution this and rebellion that and, overturning hierarchy, blah, 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 blah. You've got to be like a punk rocker. You got to hang out at the hippest club in your city. You got to dye your hair green, and then you'll be a good manager. And the company that when they write these books, they always focus on one or two or three companies and use them as examples. His main example was Enron. That's right. But these people, you know, sort of, there are many other examples of how this crisis has just been, you know, so utterly perfect. Another one, this was in the Wall Street Journal just a short time ago. There is a statistic that you used to hear all the time in the new economy days, that the number of users of the internet was growing by like 1,000% a year or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And this was a statistic that was never questioned. You saw it all over the place. You know, Bill Clinton quoted it, Bob Dole, everybody quoted it. You know, it later turned out that the actual number was something like, you know, it was considerably less than that, like 100%. Still significant, but not the kind of crazy, off-the-scale progress that everybody was talking about. But this was just never questioned at the time. And the number itself had just been invented by somebody, you know, and then, you know, got thrown around in the media echo chamber so many times that people just assumed it was true, you know.
Yeah, we're talking to Tom Frank today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. We're talking about Tom's new book, One Market Under God, Extreme Capitalism, Market Populism, and the End of Economic Democracy, published by Doubleday. Available in paper now, is it not, Tom?
It is, yeah, and it's got a new afterword where I gloat and dance up and down and say, I told you so.
You know, if you'd like to call in and talk to Tom, our number is 333-9455, and the toll-free number is 1-800-222-9455. We've got another 15 or 20 minutes left, so call in if you have any questions. Despite all the gloating and despite what has happened...
I don't really do that.
No, though. Okay, but let's say you did gloat, because you certainly are entitled to. But despite what's happened, say, with the Enron, WorldCom, Global Crossing, with the collapse in the stock market and in what's happened to workers' pension funds, what's happened to the economy in general, have we seen a shift in the intellectual climate to correspond to this? What sort of period are we in now? If we're not in the glory days of George Gilder, are we in the opposite?
Well, it's funny because people ask me that a lot, and I just about a month ago, I went on a book tour of Australia, and I would tell people this, all the, you know, what I myself had witnessed in America, which is during the Enron fiasco, the public was so angry, even people that I know who don't really pay attention to economic stuff and don't really care about it, were so mad at the way this company had cheated people and the high-handed way they'd done it and the way that they, you know, with the way that the free pass that they had been given by the business world while doing all this. People were furious. People were outraged.
Americans.
It really brought everything together for them. You know, it was a perfect disaster. And I honestly thought that the Democrats would use this to beat Bush up and would be able to pull off some kind of big victory in the recent congressional elections, the same way that they did in 1930. When free markets, you know, self-destruct like they did, like they have done the last 2.5 years, that's a time when people no longer. Obviously, their faith in free markets should be shaken by an incident like that. They should start turning to other options, you know. And we have this party that has historically been that, constituted that other option. And I have to say, it was my suspicion that war would trump economic downturn, but I didn't think it would do it this dramatically. I thought the Democrats would be able to pull something out, but you know, they really didn't. They just didn't try. I didn't hear word one about this stuff in this campaign, and it's just astonishing. They were just there. They've been handed a historical situation where they should profit, where they, you know, and that they should be able to gain from, and they did nothing with it. I'm just...
Yeah, before we go on, I want to make a point. Our producers just notified me that we're having trouble with our phone system. So, Tom, if you're wondering why you haven't gotten any calls, don't take it personally.
No, it's no big deal. Nobody, you know...
No. Actually, apparently a number of people have been trying to call, but we're having trouble a lot with our phone system today, and I don't think we'll be able to take calls. So I guess I would tell people, don't try to call now. let me do... I'll try to read everyone's minds and ask the questions
ask. Can I tell you a funny story?
Please do.
So I when the book came out, I did a lot of shows like this, and a lot of them are with people who have never read the book and don't know anything about me. You know, unlike this is a rare one when you have a commentator who knows as much as you do and who's actually read the material. But they often, you know, they'll listen to me talk for a while, then they'll say, okay, well, Tom, you know, I have a question for you, and they'll say, I just have to ask this: are you a communist? All the time. And then, and then after I assure them that, you know, I'm not, because, you know, people don't even know, they haven't heard anybody talk like this for so long that it's, you know, or maybe never, that they assume that anybody on the left is a communist of some kind. And then after that, then they always go, okay, they're like, oh, good, they're relieved, they've cleared the air. Then they say, okay, well, then here's my other question. You know, what should I put my money in now? This always happens, and people call in and ask me about certain stocks and stuff like that. It's like sports radio or something.
You know, but going back to the Democrats, Tom, you know, it's how much of it is that they were part of this sort of new economy hysteria?
Oh, absolutely.
And the deregulation, but sort of didn't give them a chance, any place to stand as critics of the process.
That's right. Well, there are some Democrats who are, you know, who are critics, but it's awful. I don't really like, yeah, but of course Clinton and Gore and many, many, many more of them, including Gephardt, all the Democratic Leadership Council types, were just as caught up in this crap as Republicans were, and are just as much to blame for it as they are. You know, it's Clinton, you know, the right loves to revile the guy, or did love to, you know, past tense there. But he was responsible for it as much as anybody else. His, you know, his announcement that the age of big government is over, all the things that he did to encourage workers to put money into their 401ks, these were things that got the bull market going and that pumped it up as high as it did. The idea that consensus had been achieved and that opposition to total free markets, to the laissez-faire idea, had effectively disappeared in America. That's what made the bull market possible. I mean, yeah. You got to remember, one of the things about Wall Street is it loves it when leftists surrender, when leftists give up, you know, when leftists lose elections. That is golden for Wall Street. And when things happen like in Britain, when the leftists say, okay, we're not going to be a left party anymore, that's the best of all.
Mm-hmm.
That's what the IMF is continually demanding from these other countries. You know, Tom Friedman writes about this in the New York Times, or used to, and I should say not in a critical way. He's sort of in favor of this, but that you know, to really be a player in the golden world of the new economy, you had to get rid of your left party. You have the democracy of markets. You don't have the democracy of democracy. Singapore is a perfect example here. You can buy whatever. They have the finest shopping malls in the world. I mean, I've been there. It's extraordinary. It blows your mind. You know, these food courts that to die for. Fantastic. You open up their op-ed page, and they don't talk about politics. I mean, they'll comment on things in other countries, but they aren't allowed to talk about politics in Singapore. What they talk about in their op-ed page is management theory. That's, you know, how to work, how to be a good worker, how to manage workers, this kind of thing.
Tom, I've got great news. Our phone lines have somehow come back to life, only in America. So let's go to the phone lines now. Line one, you're on the air with Tom Frank.
Yeah, I was wondering about something that I'd read before when I was reading about the 1920s. And what I read was that Andrew Carnegie, I think that's it, Andrew Carnegie was he was preaching the gospel of wealth, and that was apparently a real big deal back then. I wonder if there's any connection with that, between that and what, you know, what's going on these days.
Hello, Tom.
Oopsie daisy.
Okay, Tom. What happened? Oops, we've lost Tom. It looks like Tom, are you there?
Yeah.
Okay. Did you hear the question?
Me?
Yeah.
I'm Tom.
I know. Did you hear the question, though?
No. I thought you said, do I have a question?
Yeah, this could be like Jeopardy.
Call. When you went to the call, my phone went dead.
Okay.
Why don't you just tell me what it was?
Well, he said how in the 1920s, Andrew Carnegie was preaching the gospel of wealth.
Yeah.
And is there a parallel to that today?
Yeah, there is. It's been a long time since I read the Carnegie thing, but that's the idea that that the billionaires would give back through philanthropy, I think, and that this is, I mean, it's been a lot, like I said, it's been a long time since I read this, and that you know, that effectively you didn't need outside forces tampering with the free market You know, you don't need labor movements. You don't need interfering government. It's just another fantasy whereby, you know, the rich will get to keep their pile, and you know, and laissez-faire is made out to be the way of heaven and the way of nature.
Now, maybe, Tom, the biggest victory or the biggest campaign that's had success in the whole market populism era of extreme capitalism that still lives with us today is this notion of the death tax.
Yeah.
I mean, because this is really quite an extraordinary...
Yeah, that's right. The estate tax, which was, I mean... One of the things that my colleagues and I say at the Baffler is that Bush and company are trying to basically repeal the 20th century. This is something that was passed in 1916. This was once such a no-brainer, you know, that they passed it back in the Wilson administration. you know, the idea that you shouldn't have inherited aristocracy in America. You should do something to keep that from happening. That and this is even in the interests of capitalism, just to make it a fair, you know, to make the free market fair. They're like, yeah, you can have laissez-faire capitalism. Just keep it fair. We don't want people building up these gigantic family fortunes over the decades and us becoming an aristocracy. That's what that was about. But they've managed to persuade people that this is in fact this. It's a death tax. It's this, you know, that it affects family farmers mainly and small business owners, and it does nothing of the kind. Golly, I remember reading a quote in the New York Times. I just couldn't believe this one. It was from a congressman who was, I guess, very religious, and he said he wanted to repeal the estate tax so that we, as we transitioned into heaven, you know, we wouldn't have to lose our belongings or something like that. I loved that line though. As we transitioned into heaven, Bob.
Yeah, I'm still there. That is a great line.
Only in America, man.
That's right. We're talking to Tom Frank, author of One Market Under God, who's been our lovely guest today. And in your book, you have several chapters that go after how journalists, cultural studies scholars, sort of address the situation of market populism. But let's talk about journalism for a second. What was your take on how journalism addressed the problem in the 1990s and how they're doing it today, dealing with business and sort of market control of society?
Well, journalists are, especially business journalists, are among the guilty parties. I think that they, and this is now pretty obvious in retrospect, that journalists puffed the bubble as much as anybody else did. You had things like CNBC, which is, you know, the stock market cable news channel, which effectively was just a conduit for CEOs and people like that, and stock pickers and brokers and Wall Street types to get on TV and hustle whatever it was they were hustling at the moment. But there were, you know, there's a lot of it's such a wide ranging panorama of error and mistakes and people screwing up, and there are even a very few but definitely significant number of journalist mea culpas that have been appearing of late. I read one in a San Francisco paper where a woman said, you know, yes, I was part of this. I puffed the bubble back in the 1990s. I worked at, and I forget which business magazine it was, but you know, there were many, many business magazines started up in the late 90s. You know, something like Fast Company ballooned up to like 500 pages. It was all advertising, you know, and they had to fill the pages. And I forget the company she puffed. I think it was Cosmo.com, which was one of these. An internet concern that there was no way its business plan could ever work. Anybody could have seen this, and she wrote a series of articles puffing it and talking about what a great investment it was in this kind of thing, and you know, now she's sorry for what she did, and she said she did it because that's all the editors wanted. They only wanted positive stories. They wanted to fill those pages with ads. You know, they wanted those 500 pages of ads. There were all these forces coming together to make sure there was no that there was no criticism out there. There was nothing, no substantial criticism. There are other factors. You know, a lot of the pundits that I talk about in the book, I'm thinking of here of a guy like James Glassman, who wrote Dow 36,000, who was a columnist for the Washington Post. Daniel Yergin, you know, who's a very big name author and who's you know, these people, their careers just keep a rolling. They aren't slowing down. They're like George W. Bush. They go from blunder to blunder, but they just get, you know, it doesn't stop them.
Yeah, you never have to say you're sorry, it seems like.
That's right. And the reason for that is that these people come out of a, you know, there's this immense background machinery that props these people up, you know, that they've come up through. And it's the right-wing foundations and the think tanks and the magazines. And these people don't care if these guys were wrong, if the Dow never goes to 36,000 and that kind of, they don't care about that because they understand that these were works of ideology, not of stock picking, not of calling it right, that these were works of ideology, and as ideology, they worked very well. Now, granted, now the ideological task is very different. You take a guy like Dinesh D'Souza, he's not writing about salt-of-the-earth billionaires anymore. He's writing about, you know, the war on terrorism. He's changed his tune. They've all changed their tune, but they haven't gone away. These people, you know, aren't embarrassed, aren't sorry for what they did. You know, Glassman is still on the Wall Street Journal op-ed page all the time. Juergen's book, what was it called, The Commanding Heights, was just made into a documentary series by PBS, for God's sake. You know, these people should be embarrassed. But there's no enforcement mechanism in the free market of ideas, is there, Bob?
No, it doesn't seem to be, because it doesn't seem like there's really been a turnaround. There have been these mea culpas you talk about among some business journalists, but nonetheless, when you read the news today, there's not a lot of new investigative critical work on deregulatory schemes, the connections of politicians to these scandals.
Not much. There's a few people at the New York Times who have done excellent work. I think Krugman, for example, has really been you know, hitting it out of the park consistently.
And yeah, I agree.
There's somebody on the business page of the New York Times who's been excellent, and I've forgotten her name. Gretchen Morgenson, that's who it is.
Mm-hmm.
She's been consistently very, very good at you know, at calling these people on their nonsense and getting it exactly right. But you know, the larger picture of journalism, you know, we're accustomed to think of journalism as a adversarial profession, as a, you know, profession where that keeps everybody else in line, that ask the tough questions and this kind of thing. And in fact, the right-wingers say, you know, they go way too far, they're biased liberal, blah, 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 blah. But in fact, journalism is so weak today, and it's also largely the doing of the market because of the effects of conglomerate control of newspapers. The paper in my hometown of Kansas City, for example, is owned by Knight Ridder. The one in Wichita is also, but the biggest chain of them all is Gannett. And in the book, I go in some detail into the Gannett style and how Gannett works. Gannett publishes USA Today.
Mm-hmm. Tom, you might hear the band is tuning up in the background.
Oh.
That means it's time.
It's about time for me to start shutting up, isn't it?
Yeah, time for me to get out of the studio and let them take over. I want to thank Tom Frank for being our guest today. He's the author of the wonderful new book, One Market Under God, published by Doubleday, out in paper. Urge you all to take a look at it. And we'll be back next week with the head of AFTRA and the head of the Newspaper Guild. And I'd like to thank you, Ben Scott, for being my producer, and thank you all for listening.